We have a great subscription offer for all our listeners. Subscribe to our digital edition for 12 months for just $24.99. That's 6 issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your inbox for less than $4.20 an issue. Only $24.99 for a full year. So don't wait. To subscribe, go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. That's australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. Hi, I'm Angela Heathcote, and this is Talking Australia, a podcast by Australian Geographic. This episode, I'm talking to Fred Watson. Fred is Australia's astronomer at large. He's going to tell us exactly how he ended up with a job title that almost sounds made up. He's going to share his view on the massive topic of light pollution and the loss of our night sky. So I'm really excited to be talking to Fred today on this episode of Talking Australia. Now, for today's episode of Talking Australia, I'm at Fred Watson's house in Terry Hills. So if you hear a cat meowing or a few chickens, don't worry. It's all good. Fred Watson, thank you so much for being with me today.
It's a great pleasure, as always.
Perfect. So I really, really wanted to chat to you today about a bunch of different things, but what I've recently been reading a lot about is dark skies, urban night sky parks, dark sky tourism, and I'm wondering where that all started and what are all these buzzwords and things like that. So I guess, can you take me back to the idea of a dark sky park? What is that? Where did that concept begin?
It actually came out of the United States. And the story does go back very much to an astronomical background. So in the 80s, astronomers in America were getting very concerned about the loss of the night sky. Sorry about the chook. In the 1980s, Americans were getting very concerned about the loss of the night sky because of urban light pollution. Many American observatories are not very far from cities because it turns out that that's where the atmospheric conditions are good for building telescopes. So an organization grew up actually based in Tucson in Arizona, which is very close to the American National Observatory at a place called Kitt Peak. And a group of people led by, there's a guy called Dr. Gar Stang, I can't remember his first name, and Dave Crawford, they were the founders of what became the International Dark Sky Association. And they became an advocacy group, principally for astronomers to start with, but then, of course, it grew into a realization that wildlife and indeed ourselves lose something if we can't see the night sky. And in fact, wildlife often loses their lives because their migrating birds are fooled by cities and things of that sort. So the organization's remit grew. And one of the ways that it was seen that you could draw attention to this and indeed draw attention to what a pristine night sky looks like is to invent a concept called dark sky places, which they did. And they had several different layers depending on the kind of territory that you're talking about. So dark sky reserves are very large areas, almost national-sized or certainly at least county-sized areas.
And the first one was in this place in Arizona.
That's right, yes. I think the first reserves might have been in the United States. The one of the biggest ones is in Namibia, actually, in southern Africa. But dark sky parks are smaller areas and often are based around national parks. And that's what happened here in Australia because we saw an opening for a possible dark sky park in Australia because the National Observatory, which I was then astronomer in charge of, the Australian Astronomical Observatory, is on a mountaintop called Siding Spring, which is in the Warrumbungle mountain range. And it's right next door to the Warrumbungle National Park. And so back in 2016, we set up the mechanisms and the paperwork.
What does that process look like? How do you get approval?
Yeah, it's long. 112 pages was the document that we submitted.
Wow.
And what it's got to show is Things like, do you have any sort of legislative protection for the night skies there?
Did we?
Indeed we did, because the observatory itself has legislative protection. It was then out to a radius of 100 kilometres from the observatory. It's now 200 kilometres. It's covered by planning and environmental regulations, actually administered by the New South Wales Department of Planning and Environment. So that was in place. That was the easy one. But then you've got to do an inventory of all the lights. If there are lights in the park, you need an inventory of them to show that they are properly shielded and they're not sending light into the sky. And of course, there are lights because there's a visitor centre there. There's toilet facilities and things of that sort. All of that stuff we had to take into account. One of the things we ran into was there's a Telstra telephone box in the national park, which has an orange roof, which is translucent. And so that fell foul of the regulations. But we got permission from Telstra to paint it with engine paint. So there's this black
Telstra
glare.
Was supportive.
Yeah, they were. Absolutely, yeah. Telstra came to the party and said, do what you like with it, because we needed to make it opaque.
So dark sky parks started in the Warrumbungles in Australia.
They did, yes, that's right. And there's at least one more. I'm not really up to speed now on where we're going with this because other people have taken the reins since I stopped being astronomer in charge at Siding Spring, which I'm delighted about. You know, it means that there's a whole cohort of people who are waving the flag for dark skies and pushing for dark sky parks and reserves and things of that sort.
Okay, so I know there's dark sky parks, but obviously there are, or from my understanding, there are different variations of dark sky parks, especially with, you can put them in all different areas. Can you kind of go into and explain that?
Sure, yeah. So as I said before, a reserve is a very large area. A park is, you know, something like a national park. But the International Dark Sky Association also recognised communities with a dark sky community level. And that is communities that might not be pristine in the quality of the night skies, but which have a strong emphasis on good lighting and minimizing light pollution. So dark sky communities are probably mostly small towns, maybe sometimes near a national park or something like that. We would like to see the town of Coonabarabran, which is right next door to the Warrumbungle National Park, recognised as a dark sky community, for example. That's something that the town itself will have to take the lead on. But that's a fairly well-established tier of the dark sky movement, the dark sky communities. But what is new is the idea of an urban dark sky park, where you've got something maybe in the centre of a city, which is an enclave of slightly, you know, lower light pollution. And so there is a push on at the moment, being led by my partner Marnie, which is to get the Palm Beach headland recognised as Australia's first urban dark sky park, maybe even the world's first urban dark sky park, because I don't think there are any yet.
I find the idea of an urban night sky park really interesting. I originally grew up on the Central Coast and I used to always be able to see the stars. And then I moved to inner West Sydney maybe 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And I feel like even walking home now, I don't look up, even though on the Central Coast when I'd walk home at night, I would. So I'm wondering, do you think people in urban environments are very disconnected from the night sky?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the problems with light pollution. It has disconnected us from the night sky in a way that I think is detrimental to our well-being, because, you know, when there are many reasons why we don't like light pollution, and health is one of them, physical health. But I think, you know, 200 years ago, we weren't blitzed by the same amount of artificial light as we are now. And of course, a lot of leisure pursuits were carried on outside rather than indoors, because that was the entertainment for the night, was watching the stars. We have lost that connection, I think. And I think that's bad for our well-being. I think connectedness with something much bigger than ourselves, you know, even the moon at 380,000 kilometres away, it's right on our doorstep. But it gives us a kind of framework often within which we live. In fact, it gives us a real framework because we have months, which are essentially the lunar cycle.
It makes
cycle.
You feel a lot smaller.
Yeah, and that might not be a bad thing sometimes.
Definitely. And can you go into light pollution in the city and the impacts that it does have on animals and humans?
Yes, that's right. So, you know, if you've got a... The problem is that cities have developed with really very little regard to the night sky. That is changing now. But we've got this legacy of really poorly designed lights that essentially send 50% of their light up into the night sky. So the first thing that you're talking about is a waste of energy. And that, and it's a colossal waste of energy. That in itself, if you've got a country or a district which is largely powered by fossil fuels, that's going to contribute to the greenhouse footprint of that area. So that's the first thing. As far as wildlife is concerned, there are many nocturnal species that are thrown completely out of whack by city lights. They include land animals, you know, some of the foraging animals, they find that their habitat is dramatically altered by the fact that they're in a region where there is light pollution. But bird life especially is also badly affected. They estimate in the United States that New York State alone, something like 2 billion birds a year lose their lives because of the light plume from New York and other cities. They wind up basically losing their way. These are migrating birds, and they see, you know, they're attracted to the lights. They either crash into buildings or they just orbit around buildings, paralyzed by the fact that there's so much light coming from them, until they drop dead. It's a colossal number. And perhaps the poster child of the dark sky movement are the loggerhead turtle hatchlings, which they pop out of their shells on a beach somewhere and look for the line of surf, which is where they've got a head. But what they find is often a line of streetlights, and that it confuses them completely. Mm. So there are actually specialists here in Australia who are researching that problem with some really interesting results.
We'll be back with our conversation with Fred Watson just after this. Subscribe to our AG magazine for 6 months for just $30 and save 33% on the newsstand price. That's 3 issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your home for just $30. So don't wait. Go to www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia for our special offer. That's www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. We're back with our conversation with Fred Watson. I found it really interesting when I was having a chat to Lisa Harvey-Smith maybe a few months ago, and she talked about the space, or space, as a type of wilderness. And then I was thinking about, the term light pollution, wilderness. It's like the movement and the dark sky movement is kind of a conservation movement in a way.
Oh, absolutely.
The way in the terminology it's using.
Yeah, that's right, yes. I mean, I've been known in the past to refer to the night sky as the greater wilderness, which it is. You know, it's the wilderness beyond. What I didn't get to in your question there was the effect on human life of light pollution. We know now that because we live in a 24/7 world, a lot of people have to work unusual hours. My son is one of them. He's a nurse, so he does shift work at night. And we now know that certain types of lighting are very detrimental to human health. This is not light pollution as such, but it's lighting that is not really geared towards protecting our well-being. And that typically is lighting that has a very strong blue component, blue-rich lighting, we call it, because blue is the colour that our, you know, the ganglion cells in front of our retinas are sensitive to, and blue light on those things immediately shuts down melatonin secretion, which spoils your circadian rhythms completely. So in terms of indoor lighting, there are issues as well. Blue light's also bad for outdoor lighting because blue light actually scatters through the atmosphere much more readily than light of a warmer colour. By warmer, I mean something more orange rather than a light with a very high blue content. So blue-rich light is bad for light pollution. It basically increases the light pollution of a city.
Mm. And I want to go into what you just mentioned about warmer lights and things like that, because I think I read that after looking at the impact of lighting on human health, I think it was the French government actually brought in laws that said, yep, hold on, this is actually how warm the lights need to be. What do you think it would take for Australia to make those kind of moves?
Well, it's happening. I was in a meeting last week along with Marnie and some other lighting specialists with the street lighting agency for northwestern New South Wales and probably other parts of New South Wales as well. And this is exactly what we're talking about. So we specify the colour of light in something called colour temperature. It's a fairly crude measure, but it's what it is. It's actually the temperature of what we call a black body, which is, imagine a lump of iron, and you heat it to that temperature. That is the colour that it would be. And we measure it in degrees Kelvin, which are from absolute zero. So, a white hot piece of iron would be at a temperature of maybe, 3,000 or 4,000 degrees Kelvin. So that's what we measure, we call the colour temperature. The colour temperature of daylight is about 5,000 Kelvin. It's quite blue rich because of the scattering effect of blue light, or the atmosphere scattering blue light. We know, though, if you want artificial light at night, a better colour temperature is 3,000, which is a warm colour. And 3,000 is the limit that the French have now imposed on all their street lighting. So if you go above that, you can't do it in France now. 4,000 degrees Kelvin, that's a much whiter, more intense light. Until relatively recently, that was the preferred fitting for street lights. These are LEDs, light emitting diodes. And the reason for that is that those high color temperature lights ran at a higher efficiency. So you got more bang for your buck. You got more light out per.
Was that an environmental issue as well? People wanting to use light saving lights?
Energy saving. Yes, to some extent, that's right. It's more that local councils recognise the bottom line. It's a hip pocket thing as well, because, if you've got higher energy lights, then they're cheaper to run. But that's changed. So the 3,000 Kelvin lights that the French are mandating now are virtually as energy efficient as the really high blue content lights. And so I think there will be a movement towards these warmer colours, which are actually much better for health. There is one slight side issue here, and that is colour recognition. There's something called a colour index, I think it is, that's how good a particular colour is at giving you, a sense of colour, which might be important, for accident reporting or whatever. You need to see the colours of things. So that was another argument for high intensity or high colour temperature lights. But I think, once again, that's being relaxed a bit. We can demonstrate that 3,000 Kelvin lights actually have as good colour recognition as the higher colour temperature ones. Mm. This is all terribly technical. but it's the way a lighting engineers think and the way they talk and really the way the lighting industry is going.
So in your role as Australia's astronomer at large, and actually before I go into my question, let's just discuss that role. How did that come about?
Because I was astronomer in charge of the Australian Astronomical Observatory, but the management of the observatory changed. It now is operated through the university sector. I, however, remained with the government department that ran it, which is the Department of Industry, Innovation and Science, in an advocacy and outreach role for science outreach generally, but it also includes dark skies and awareness of light pollution. But there was a conversation that said something like, well, what we're going to call you? Well, if we called you the astronomer at large, we'd only have to change four letters on your office door from astronomer in charge. And so we all laughed and fell about, in mirth, and said things like, a police have warned that there is an astronomer at large. Don't approach them. But it turned out that our minister very much liked the idea. And so I became Australia's first astronomer at large.
Yeah. And what are some of the challenges you face as Australia's astronomer at large when we have more people living in urban environments, more people impacted by light pollution, not seeing what they could be seeing. What are some of the challenges that you face as someone who advocates for night skies?
You know, it's pretty easy to get people excited and inspired by the night sky, even in the urban environments that we live in, because everybody's interested in the broader picture. The fact that they see the universe as holding secrets in regard to our origin and perhaps our ultimate destiny. These are all things that excite people and interest them. And so there is definitely a readiness among the population in general to go outside and find a dark sky place and have a look. And so one of the things that I try and do is tell them where they can do that, whether it's with an astronomical society or in a dark sky place, dark sky park. There is, I think, a great hunger within Australia to know about these things, and that, of course, it makes my job very easy indeed.
And it, say, for example, someone like me, if I came up to you and said, Fred, I'm really, really keen on space. I want to know more about it. I want to be able to observe it more. I live in inner West Sydney. What would you say I do?
Well, a lot depends on...
Asking for a friend.
How you want to deal with it. You know, it's asking for a friend. Yeah. it's actually, a lot of people are in exactly that situation. One thing I always suggest is to make contact with an astronomical society, not necessarily join them, but maybe go along to one of their open nights. And there are many in most of the big cities in Australia. They have astronomical societies that often have their own observatories, and they hold pretty regular open nights, sometimes star parties or sky watching, things of that sort. Go along there. In Sydney, you can, of course, go to Sydney Observatory as well, which has regular observing sessions. And you can talk to people there and find out, you know, what it is that excites them. You can have a look through telescopes in the company of people who know and love the sky and know their way around the sky. And then you can take it from there. You know, whether you just want to be an armchair astronomer and look at things online, you can do a lot of citizen science actually online now from your armchair that contributes directly to astronomy. Things like the Galaxy Zoo, SETI at Home is another one. These are all projects that people can get involved with that actually allow them to contribute really to a proper science. And then if you do want to find yourself a telescope, then you can do it very cheaply or you can do it very expensively. And I was astonished, only a few days ago, to have the opportunity to check out a absolutely new type of telescope, which mixes normal optical, you know, the normal lenses and mirrors that you have with a telescope, with electronic detectors. And this is a telescope that actually lets you see very faint objects, galaxies and nebulae, things that are really at the very low level of vision, in an urban environment, because the electronics will subtract the sky background.
Oh, wow.
And reveal the colours in some of these objects. It'll cost you $3,000, but it is...
It's a little bit out of my budget.
Yeah, mine too, I can tell you. But it's an extraordinary development, and I think this will contribute a lot to people's awareness of what the night sky has to offer. It's just another, another part of the arsenal of equipment that we have at our disposal to look at the night sky.
And when you are communicating with people who live in urban environments who don't have the same or the initial same passion that you do for space, what's a particular topic that you think draws them in the most?
So I do a lot of talks to schools and to interest groups, and as well as, you know, the general public. And it the kind of things that really engages people our studies of the solar system, sorry about the cat, because we now have spacecraft that are exploring the solar system and showing us things that we just never realised about the planets, particularly Saturn, Mars and planets that have had orbiting spacecraft. All that switches people on. And along with the quest for life, because we now live in an era where there's a science known as astrobiology, which is not actually necessarily about looking for life in space. It's about studying the origins of life and the kinds of environments that life might emerge in. And astrobiology really engages people because it leads directly to the question of whether we're alone or not, in terms of, you know, other species out there, and also the you know, the big questions, the big picture, the origin of the universe, the Big Bang, the event in which we think the universe was created 13.8 billion years ago. That's the sort of thing that engages people too.
Mm. And was that the kind of thing that engaged you in space when you first got involved with or, you know, developed your passion for space? Like, do you ever go back to what drew you in and try to use that on other people?
Yep, I do. because, look, I grew up in an era where things were very different from what they are now. There had recently been a world war fought on the basis of science and technology. Everybody thought there was going to be another one, so science was very much the flavour of the month. You studied science at school. It was just the normal thing. I got passionate about astronomy then. It was a time, you know, when space studies were advancing. The first Earth satellite was launched in 1957. I remember that quite clearly. So all of that was engaging, not just me, but all of my peers. But they grew up and did sensible things like became doctors and engineers and architects and things like that. And I just kept this fascination with the sky and did use a small telescope, which I actually borrowed from one of my teachers. He was an astronomy nut. And what drew me in was looking at the moon. There's nothing quite like looking through a telescope at the moon for the first time. And you see this world that's got mountains and craters and another worldliness that is really very difficult to put into words.
I feel like now you have to tell us how you celebrated the 50th anniversary of the moon landing.
By doing many, many radio interviews and talks and TV things. And actually, I did a dinner under the moon with at Questacon.
Oh my gosh, big moon shop.
They've got a 7-meter diameter moon there, and they had a dinner, and I and a colleague of mine from the National Measurement Institute waxed lyrical about the moon and Apollo and all the rest of it. We had a great time.
And I wanted to go back to what we were talking about, urban night skies, connecting more people. I think one of the things that gets people excited is being able to contribute to what I mentioned about, you know, a conservation issue. So how can people help light pollution on an individual level?
Yes, they can be aware of it, first of all. And actually, this comes with a government health warning, because when you start looking at what you know to be good and bad light fittings, particularly in street lighting and things like that, you can't help yourself. Everywhere you go, you think, oh God, that's a terrible lamp there. It's beaming light into the sky. You suddenly become, you know, very engaged with your environment. So when you're doing things in your own property, your own homes, excuse me, keep getting this frog in my throat. I apologise for that. It's a light polluted frog. When you're putting a backyard light in or something like that, be aware of the fact that there are good and bad ways of doing that. And the good ways are the ones that keep the light, direct light, always below the horizontal plane, rather than spreading it upwards into the sky. A lot of people light up their backyards with lights that are tilted up so that the beam goes right to the back of the yard.
Yeah, I noticed that when you walk past someone's house and a spotlight goes on, it just covers the whole road.
Yeah, that's
right.
Is
that necessary?
Well, not only is it unnecessary, it also contravenes a Australian standard called AS4282, which is about...
Write that down, folks.
Which is about obtrusive lighting, and that's what it is. You know, that's something called light trespass. What you're doing is your light is trespassing onto somebody else's property.
I have never heard that term, light trespassing.
Yeah, so, and there is a standard that essentially, standards don't prohibit things, but they say you shouldn't use that. And if it came to a legal case, the standard would be upheld. So light trespass is one of the, you know, one of the ills of lighting, as is glare. That, you know, the other thing that often happens with those backyard lights is they're tilted up to light up the back fence. And that means the person on the other side of the back fence has got this blazing light in their face. That is very detrimental as well, not just to health, but also to safety, because you find that, you know, intense lights like that create shadows that are the perfect places for crooks and miscreants to hide. So good lighting isn't necessarily bright or always about, you know, lighting places. It's about doing things sensibly.
Mm. And another thing I've been really curious about is, obviously, if you live in an urban area, you don't have to wait for space to come to you. You can go to space. I mean, actually, you can't go to space, but you can experience the night sky in different ways. So when you mentioned the Warren Bungles, people can obviously travel there and whatnot. And I've noticed recently that a lot of different travel companies are promoting dark sky tours and dark sky tourism. Can you explain where that comes from, that whole dark sky tourism? And is it picking up now? How long has that been around?
Dark sky tourism is a relatively recent phenomenon. And it comes about because people do want to experience what a proper dark sky looks like. Often they've got a passing interest, not maybe a passionate interest, but a passing interest in astronomy and trying to see the planets through small telescopes and things like that. So a good dark sky tour would have that facility. It would have somebody who could guide people around the stars and show them what's in the sky. And it would have telescopes so that they can have a look in more detail about it. There are also more specialised ones that do fit the bill of dark sky tours, but they're going to places like the northern region of Scandinavia to see the Aurora Borealis, the Northern Lights, or actually southern Tasmania to see the Aurora Australis, the southern lights, because those are phenomena that are, you know, you can actually see them if they're bright enough in light polluted conditions. I've seen the Northern Lights from the centre of Reykjavik, right in the middle of the town, which is not good for light pollution. And yet you can see the Northern Lights still. But it's far better if you're viewing that in a dark sky. And so, you know, that feeds directly into dark sky tourism of a rather specialist kind.
One thing I feel like I've always dreamed of being is a national parks ranger. And when I read about the Australian Geographic expedition to Sliding Springs soon, and they had this title for the ranger that took people around as Night Sky Ranger.
Yeah,
this excited me so much. Can you please explain what is a Night Sky Ranger?
Well, I think the person I know her quite well. The person you're thinking of is basically what I've just described, somebody who knows and loves the sky, has a very, very good knowledge of the sky and access to small telescopes as well. So it's that's a fantastic thing to be doing, to be you know, helping people to understand the night sky and to get used to it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for speaking to me today, Fred.
It's a great pleasure. Thanks, Angela.
And as Fred mentioned before, if you'd like to find out more about the experts and the dark sky movement in Australia, you can visit AustralasianDarkSkyAlliance.org. That's it for today's episode of Talking Australia with Fred Watson. If you have questions or comments, feel free to reach out. Write us an email, podcast@australiangeographic.com, or find us on Instagram @AustralianGeographic. And if you go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia, you'll find a special subscription offer. So don't wait. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast from. Thanks for listening. Until next time.